Thank you, Bert. That was wonderful. Wasn't that grand? I tell you, it's just picture yourself in those places there where all that wonderful, momentous events took place. But we can travel there even if you've never been to Israel. In your heart, you know it is so. Well, tonight I trust that it'll be rather special. As Bert mentioned, I did bring along a friend. Is it okay? He asked what his name was. I just made it up, brother. I just wanted to see if he could tongue-tie you a little bit. Marcus Aurelius Maximus Antiochus or something, you know. I mean, they always named themselves with these really big, long names, right? You know, and they always had the names with some kind of really grandiose tough, you know, like I'm a tough guy. You know, I'm a tough guy. And yeah, they were. When I first got that, I have this in my office. And when I first got it, you know, I put it in. And for many a night, it scared Janice to no end and I, because, you know, we always thought somebody was standing there, you know, when you had to go in and make sure the door was locked. And, okay. You know. And then after a while, and then as I worked there, every now and then I would glance up at him. And he's intimidating, don't you think? I guess if you were a little bit closer and just kind of sit and just look at, you know, he's big. Now, they would have been a little bit shorter in those days there, but he would have been really armed up to the tilt like you see there. And I picture in my heart and mind, wow, I mean, just one guy himself, would you tangle with him? And then I imagine, you know, thousands of these guys side by side lined up. And they would go and conquer the world. And I think of Israel, those zealots who were so fed up with the hope of a Messiah, a political Messiah that would come on the scene, and they thought maybe Jesus would have been that one, and, you know, he came offering a kingdom that was not the kingdom that they thought, and they wanted Barabbas because he was one of them, and, you know, he fought with the literal sword as opposed to the sword of the Spirit that Jesus was talking about. Those zealots had what we would say in Hebrew, chutzpah. Real lot of chutzpah. Because when you see these guys and you think you could tangle with them, man, that takes some kind of real chutzpah in one's being. They say, wow. And tangle with one of these guys or the whole entire army or regiment and think you can win? You really have to be either really absorb and think that you can really conquer these guys, or you're just completely insane. But I'm going to reserve the actual description of the significance of those specific armament that makes up the Roman legionnaire that the former rabbi of Tarsus, Paul, mentioned in the book of Ephesians chapter 6. He was chained to one. He would have been probably a Praetorian guard. This is a legionnaire, one of those common soldiers of the day. But he had seen Roman soldiers all around him all the time. And he knew of their fortitude. He knew of their discipline. He knew of their just their commitment to win, to succeed, that he recognized that this is what a believer should have and should be equipped and trained and skilled just as these guys were. And so we'll discuss the specifics, Lord willing, Wednesday evening. But tonight I'll just kind of give a little talk, a little bit about the Romans in Israel, Romans, the conquerors in the Holy Land, and just kind of get a little bit of the mindset and discuss a few of those Romans that we're so familiar with. Now, I want you to do some things for me. I want some of you to turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11. And then 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11. Okay. And then if some of you, or if you want, you could also have your finger ready for 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. I do this at a Bible study because sometimes of the, you know, going back and forth, if somebody's there, then you get to read it out loud and everybody gets to hear it and we can pretty move along. This is, by the way, what I would teach in a mixed crowd, even with Jewish people. So I'm sharing you what I would share with them and how I would do it. And So, 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. And then there'll be two other passages that I'll draw attention to later. But I just want you to be ready with these as when I call upon and we'll consider the meaning of the verse there. Now, any of you taking Latin? Are you familiar with Latin? Anybody? If I said to you, Vini, Vidi, Vinci, what have I said? Ooh, that's good. That's really good. All right. Now, for the million-dollar question, who said it? Witty. Witty. Who said it? Julius Caesar. Yes, exactly. Julius Caesar. I came, I saw, and I conquered. You can't get any more simplified than that, right? And so that basically becomes the motto, the design of the whole Roman objective and their conquests of the world at that time. I came, I saw, and I conquered. And it got to a point that Rome and its leaders and its emperors began to think of themselves immortal, invincible, because who can stop Rome? And that was the world that Jesus came into, where there was that attitude, that sentiment on the part of the world group at the time. I came, I saw, and I conquered. Now, the banner that you see there, it says Legion 10 Franciscus. There were a lot of legions, but this is the one I kind of focused on and hung on and tried to research a lot. There's a reenactment group that seeks to create this group. When I was putting this together and I made some email contacts and calls on the phone and so on, of course, they wanted me to join. They wanted me to, you know, join, and then I guess they go on these reenactments and they fight barbarians. and then they told me, because I told them that, you know, what I do vocational-wise, and he says, well, you know, we do a lot of Eastern passions, and we just sit outside this tomb, and that's all we do. We sit there. And then somewhere later, we kind of move the stone, and then we continue sitting there and look shocked. You might like that, he says. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it? That's what I said. Yes, all right, just a Roman soldier sitting outside. And then also they wanted me to, you know, acquire a Roman name and everything else. And, of course, not only do they reenact the Roman legionnaire in practice and everything else, but they also implement the paganism and the heathenism associated with it as well. So I said, no, I'll be one of the guys that you all throw to the lions, you know. So I just want to put it together for another purpose, and I got to share with them a little bit about it. But I did focus on Legion 10 Franciscus. Legion 10, the 10th Legion of Rome, were formed by Julius Caesar. In fact, there's a book out there called Caesar's Legions. It's the 10th. These guys become the crack troops, the storm troopers of the day. The 10th Roman Legion, when one wanted to join, they wanted to join this particular outfit. These were comparable to like the modern armies that are immortal because of their exploits, like the Fighting 69th and the 101st Airborne and all these armaments today. There's a history. The 10th Roman Legion are the guys that took out Jerusalem in AD 70, along with two other legions. These are the guys that were ordered to stay after the destruction of Jerusalem as a garrison to kind of keep things in place a little bit. And the Western Wall, you know, that Jewish wall where the Jewish men and, you know, would pray and went and they stick prayers and papers in those cracks. Okay, that wall was left there for two reasons. One, they wanted to leave it as a testimony for the entire world to see, as we go there and see it, and you see it through pictures and so, the magnificent and the solidness of the Jerusalem walls, that even that could not keep these guys out. So it was a reflection that how greater Rome was. When you look at that wall and you go, wow, you know, the first seven major stones that you see are the Herodian stones of the days of Herod. The ones on the top are other conquerors that came and just added onto the walls. But the bottom seven there, those are Herodian stones, huge things. If you want to go down to street level in the time of Christ, you've got to go eight more. Then if you want to go to bedrock, you've got to go nine more. And just standing at those walls there, and you look up, and you just see it, that it's hard, it's solid, it's strong. I mean, you wonder, Lord, the determination, what would it have taken for these guys to just go up against these walls? I excavated some of the walls there along the street, by the wall there in the southwest corner, and you can see pictures there, and the tour groups go there now, and you see just this massive stones that the Romans, they brought their battering rams up to the top and just smashed those stones off right after the tier, and they came crashing down onto the flagstone, the streets there, killing the fleeing Jewish people, and onto the shops there. And as I walked through there and it was excavating and sifting, we found coins, we found pottery, we found bird bones, because that was the section where people who couldn't afford lambs would buy turtle doves and pigeons. So you remember that passage in Scripture? That's probably where they had purchased it. But then we found human remains, too. And that was, boy, I tell you, that is something that just made the hairs of my arms rise, because it's one thing to read, but then all of a sudden to see it, it's incredible. But they left that wall there as a testimony. And then the second was to protect these guys. It was sort of like a buffer, the 10th Legion that stayed there. And then these guys were sent to Masada and to take out that huge fortress there in the Judean desert, Masada, which is just an impregnable city, and the defenders stood there as long as they could until finally Rome eventually took over the place. So, you know, the 10th Roman legions were the tough guys. They were the tough guys. And I'm still doing a lot of research trying to find a little more about them. They were recruited from Spain, by the way. So maybe there's a little connection there. I do have a Spanish background. I guess some of you guessed my last name by now. Some of you are curious. What is that, French? Italian? It's not Jewish. Though I many of my Jewish students says Cologne? I said, no, it's Cologne. It's with a little accent on the second O, Cologne. You've heard of a guy named Cristobal Colon? Christopher Columbus? I share the same name, Cristobal Colon. When I was researching Dr. Ross Valley, eventually I had to go to the Mormon church for the genealogical research there. I stalled as long as I could, but someone says, if you're going to do any kind of research of anybody's genealogy, you have to go eventually to the Mormon church, because they have all those machines and they have everybody's records. So I took out my files, learned everything about the Mormons so I could witness to them, and then got a pair of dark sunglasses and parked my car behind the church, you know, far away in case somebody recognized me. Knocked on the door, got inside, and lo and behold, as I told him who I was, they go, yes, just sign here. And I put my name, and they went crazy. They went nuts when they saw my name, because here they thought it was an opportunity for me, because the Mormon teaching is that you were baptized for the dead, you know, for ancestors, so they could go into this other level of heaven. There's strange doctrines they had. They thought maybe they can help Christopher Columbus. Here we are. What was the sentence here? You can baptize for Cristobal Colon. We have records that go all the way back to the 1300s and so, please. I said, no, I'm not interested in him. I was stunned. I said, I'm interested in this other guy. And so they were just shocked about it. And then after a while, I was able to witness to them as I told them the story. And by the way, there was a lot of Jewish people there researching and trying to find members of their families that were lost in Europe and in Germany and the war and that sort of thing. So there were all these Jewish folks there. So, wow, what an opportunity. But anyway, Cristobal Colon. And the ancestry, my folks are from Puerto Rico. But, of course, you know, Spain was the main conqueror of that time, and going all over, so there might be some Spanish connection there. So the 10th Legion formed there from Spain. They become the real tough guys, and their symbol is the boar. That boar, that real rough boar, and that's basically, you know, what they wanted to show, how fierce and tough they are. But again, Julius Caesar said, "I came, I saw, I conquered." You know, just the whole sentiment, feeling of Rome. But let's look at 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11. Something that the Jewish people, who, to the extent that they were familiar with their own scriptures, they no doubt would have been well familiar with this passage here. "Thine, O God, is the greatness, and the power, and the glory, and the victory, and the majesty. For all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all." Now, I doubt many of them would have gone up to, you know, one of these guys and said, "Let me quote you 1 Chronicles 29, verse 11. I don't think so. It may, maybe you might have had some, but this is the attitude that Israel had. They knew who the true king was. They knew their God. And they have been conquered by so many people. They saw what God did to the Egyptians, as we'll be hosting the Passover tomorrow, and we'll talk about what God did to the Egyptians. I had this Jewish doctor one time who told me that his daughter was married to an Egyptian. He said he just loves Passover because he gets to beat up the Egyptians once a year. and then after the Egyptians, who was? You know, you got the other peoples. You got the Assyrians, and then you got then you have the Babylonians, and then you would have the Persians, and then you have the Greeks, and then you have the Romans. There's always been some group that had come on the scene, coming with the attitude that their kingdom is going to what? Last forever, the millennium. They're going to establish the final say, the civilization. There it is. Everyone else is going to be subservient to them. And after a while, the Jews begin to realize that these guys, what? Come and they go. And there is no need to be fearful. Oh, they might have the might for the moment, but they're going to what? They're going to go. They're going to pass the scene. And the Jew, Israel, is always going to be. They're always going to be here. That's one of the reasons why some anti-Semites are so offended against Jewish people. I've had them say to me, he says, "You know what bothers me about the Jews? They're still here." Yeah. I said, "You know, it's easier to read about these ancient civilizations and these peoples that have gone, you know, have been here, but they're gone. But the Jew, he's still here." And that's irritating. And of course, they don't know, but I might take it a little further. I said, it's because they represent that God keeps his word. They're always here because God says so. And if God is faithful to them, God is faithful to all his promises, including the promises that he's made to us. So the Jews just acquired this whole sense of an attitude that whatever is going on here on the earth, whoever is the new bully on the block, God is still in control above all. You know, we can learn from that. You feel overwhelmed with who's in power? I'm not talking about our present government, but the world. You know, the bullies over in the Middle East, whether it be Iran, whether it be Syria, whether it be the terrorist groups, Islam, this group, that group, the Soviet Union, and all these different... You know, they're around and they're threatening, they're rattling the sabers and everything else. But if you could acquire that sense like the Jewish nation has, now they may not have today, but we as believers in the Bible, they're going to come and they're going to what? They're going to go. And the reason why is because of God, our Lord, is great and he is powerful, and to him is all the glory, victory, and majesty. Boy, having an attitude like that can really change our perspective, wouldn't it? In our worldview, go ahead and serve God to the utmost. And fear not what they would do to our bodies. It makes no difference. God's word will continue to flourish and do its purpose as he so decreed. So I like reading that passage in contrast that to the whole Roman thought and attitude. But let's take it to 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. Of course, this is the passage that John had talked about, which covers the same kind of sentiment that we ought to have in that sense of victory. For whatsoever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. Our faith. And, of course, faith is going to be one of the features here in the armor. And without, faith is what implements everything. If you didn't have your faith, okay, your shield, then nothing works. You really have to exercise and know the value of your faith, because that's where the victory is. You're claiming that which has already been done in our present age. Let's look at some of the famous Romans that we have in Scripture and our history here. There was a Roman historian. We always talk about Josephus. He was the Jewish historian, an eyewitness to the first century events, including the destruction of the temple. But there was another historian, a Roman fellow by the name of Tacitus, and his works are very good because it does add and share and collaborates with some of these outside sources to the events that had taken place. But in 63 B.C., a Roman soldier did the unthinkable. And let me read what this Roman historian wrote and said about him. The first Roman to subdue the Jews and set foot into their temple, specifically the Holy of Holies, that secret inner chamber of the temple. The first Roman, by right of conquest, which was 63 B.C., was Gnaeus Pompey. Thereafter, it was a matter of common knowledge that there was no representation of the gods within, the Holy of Holies, but that the place was empty and the secret shrine contained nothing. I kind of like this passage because what it is, it's a fact in which when Pompey went into the Holy of Holies, he pulled the curtain to see what was behind there, which only the high priest alone entered in one day out of the whole year, on Yom Kippur, Yoma, the day. And lo and behold, what did he find? Nothing. See, it was rumored that these Jews worshipped the golden head of a mule. Yeah. So, he went in and took a look. There was nothing there. It is reported that he said these words. I don't know if it's... He said, it's true. It's true. These people, the Jews, worship an invisible God. It's true. They worship an invisible God. Imagine that. That was so shocking. Because in those days, how can you worship something that you cannot see? And the Jews were viewed as atheists. And that's because they refused to acknowledge other gods, and then they worship a god that you can't see. So they must be what? An unknown god, a god that's not there. So they're atheists. Isn't that weird? You know, how things change. But Pompey, I find that interesting. And of course, as I share this portion with my Jewish audience that I, you know, have the privilege of talking to and sharing with, I read this, and then we talk about the Ark of the Covenant. What was in that room, and what was so important about it? It was gone. It was probably hidden, for sure, somewhere. But Pompey, that's one classic guy that you ought to be familiar with in terms of the biblical history. He's not mentioned in the Bible, but he has a major factor. Because he's the guy that took away the Jewish rulership. You know, he had different Jewish leaders that had pretty much ruled the people. Rome pretty much just put these guys in between them to kind of control the people. But with the rebellion and these Jewish puppet rulers that Rome set up, they didn't work. Pompey, when he came in, from that moment on, there was a direct rulership with Rome, with the Jews. Now they're going to have, in those days, they called them prefects. Later, they're going to be known as percolators. No. I keep saying that, don't I? But no, it's procurators. Percolators. Can you imagine that? Prefects. Yeah. There's going to be direct contact with Rome, and now that's going to set the stage for eventual conflicts, right? Conflicts that are going to happen. But it all began with Pompey and him going into that Holy of Holies as one of his deeds and acts and finding nothing there. Let's look at Matthew chapter 22, if you would. Matthew chapter 22, verse 19. Here's another very famous Roman. We're going to mention this, Lord willing, tomorrow at the Seder. But one of the religious groups, along with another group called the Herodians, the Pharisees and Herodians are going to come and they're going to question Jesus in the area of his allegiance. And we read in Matthew 22, starting at verse 19, that Jesus asked, "Show me the tribute tax money." The tribute tax money, because the question was, should we pay taxes to Rome? Well, and they brought unto him a penny. Actually, it's a denarius. It's like a silver, very, almost the size of a dime, very small. And very expensive today, right, brother, when we have to go collect coins? Brought unto him a penny, a denarius. And he said unto them, those who were challenging him, "Who is this image in superscription, you know, this writing? Who is this?" And they said unto him, "Caesar's." And then said he unto them, "Well, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Now, the coin, you have the image of Caesar, but the writing on the top signifies that this is Tiberius, the son of the living God Augustus. Now, Caesar Augustus, his father, when he died, was elevated to the status of a deity. His wife, Augustus' wife, Livia, when she passed on, she then was elevated to the position of deity as well, as a goddess. So Tiberius is basically the son of God in that time. So when Jesus asks, okay, that's the son of God, and of course he made clear who he was, he threw the challenge back to them. And they didn't play basketball in those days, but you know, the ball now was in their court. You ever heard that expression? And you give to God who you think he deserves, and you give to God what you think he deserves. You know, you give to him. So Tiberius, a Roman contact there, and it's building up now. It's really building up, the tension that's going on here. Let's look at John chapter 18. John chapter 18, verse 37 and 38. Here's another very famous guy. His name is Pontius Pilate. As you're turning there, every time I see Pontius Pilate or mention his name, I'm reminded of some story I read somewhere. It was an illustration, or maybe I heard it from a preacher or pastor somewhere, when the Sunday school class, some kids were asked to, you know, paint the or draw the story of Christmas. And all these kids drew, you know, and it was all fun and nice. So then when the teacher saw these pictures, and, you know, they all looked very nice. But there was one that was very curious. They had this airplane. It was an airplane. And, you know, and then there was these characters. They were three, and he said, "There's four people." He says, "Well, who's this here?" So the young child says, "Well, that's Joseph, and that's Mary, and that's the baby Jesus." He says, "Well, who's this fourth guy?" Pontius the Pilate. That was great. That was so cute. That's so good. The other guy might be Pontius Pilate. You know, so think of that drawing that child drew somewhere. Well, he was prefect of Judea from AD 26 to 36. He was, you know, just really a nobody, but he is one big mucker now because of his connection with the gospel narrative, right? Who does not know Pontius Pilate? He's the one that, remember, Jesus was brought and wouldn't answer any of his questions in front of the leaders. Jesus did talk to him only when Pilate took Jesus inside the Praetorium, you know, removed him from the accusers. And there, Jesus would talk to him. But as long as they were in the presence of the Jewish leaders, he wouldn't answer. Well, on one occasion, when Jesus wouldn't answer, he says, "You don't answer? Don't you not know that I have the power to what? To crucify you? Set you free?" And he did. I mean, hey, he's Rome. He represented all of the might of Rome. And of course, Jesus says, "You have no power over me unless that which God gave to you." And so, you know, he probably just recognized that he's just maybe a dreamer or so. But you know what is striking? Let's read this in John chapter 18, verse 37. Pilate therefore said unto him, "Art thou a king then?" And Jesus answered, "Thou sayest that I am a king. And to this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. And everyone that is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate said unto him, and there's that classic statement, "What is truth?" Back in 1969, and I'll probably mention this again in one of our morning sessions here, an Italian excavation team was excavating in Caesarea Maritime. Caesarea is that area that's on the Mediterranean. It was really the Roman capital in the time of Christ. That was their major headquarters. It was the New York City of that time. That's where you wanted to be. Jerusalem was the last place you wanted to go because of the religious sentiments there and all that sensitivity that you had to apply, and it was just a pain in the neck. But in Caesarea, everything goes. Everything is fun and games. You had pagan stuff, you had entertainment, you had liberal Jews, you had Greeks, and it was the good place to be. So if you had to pull duty in Jerusalem, you weren't a happy camper. It was bad. Well, this excavation team was excavating in Caesarea, the big amphitheater that you see there to this day. And they were going up the various steps that led to the various seatings up in this theater. And one of the fellas with real sharp eyes noticed this rather engraving or chicken scratch on the top landing step on the Caesarea, you know, stadium there. And most excavators always carry a brush, you know. We always walk around with a little brush or something, you know, brushing everything. So he brushes away, and all of a sudden he reads and he goes, "Oh, wow, this is an inscription stone. It's a commemorative stone of some kind of a structure." And it said something that this was built in honor of, and it went on, and it saw that it was Tiberius. "Wow, this is important." And they kept going down, and then all of a sudden it said, "Prefect Pontius Pilate." And of course, by the wording, you know, they will figure that out. So this was, here you got Pontius Pilate's name being mentioned on a stone outside of the Bible. And it was used, apparently, at a time when Pilate had built a pagan temple, and that stone was put in a wall, and it was in honor of Tiberius. But since Caesarea was prone to disasters all the time, either natural, like earthquakes or armies, these buildings crumble. And what happens, people come and they take the good stones that are in good shape and they use them, reuse them for other building projects. And those are called secondary uses in archaeological terms, you know, because you find something that dates from another time and another structure, and it makes them for some really interesting and challenging evaluations in these cases here. But here's a case, an inscription stone that bears Pontius Pilate's name, of all things, on the landing step of the stairs. And I've read that, and I've gone there, and I've seen it. They had that inscription down in Fort Lauderdale. They brought some of the artifacts from the Museum of Israel, and I was taking tours, church tours, to see all the different artifacts and things, and there was that stone there. But you know what I couldn't help but think? Here's the man, representative of Rome and all its might and all that its glory, you know, and they thought they'll live forever. Pontius Pilate is Roman's representation. He had the power. He talked to our Lord saying that he had the power to crucify him or set him free. He was the, remember I used the word macher, that means big shot. You know, he was the big guy, okay? You know what I can't help but think? That for a good time, many people stepped on his name. Huh? You know, right? I mean, to get to their seats, they have to walk on that stone. I said, wow, they walked on his name. I mentioned it to somebody. He says, oh, you Christian guy. I mean, you religious people. How you see things so differently. I said, that's the wonder. God's testimony. The legacy of Pontius Pilate, representative of Rome, and his name is what? Stepped on. And then as I excavated and dug around, we find a lot of Roman stuff. And you know, a lot of people just throw it away. It's too common. To me, I thought, hey, this is great stuff. This is thousands of years stuff. You know what happens after a while? You start getting that type of mentality. When I started finding Roman things, I said, I wasn't that thrilled. Because I walked on Roman streets. You see Roman walls. It's too modern. It's too common. You want to go deeper. You want to go to the earlier stages. And so they told me, you caught the bug, you see. You caught the bug. Anything on top, the first 2,000-3,000 years, it's too modern for us. I think I got back now. I can appreciate, you know, anything older than a week. But it just tells me, Pontius Pilate, and that inscription, you can see it, they walked on his name, the might of Rome. Now, here's a coin that I wish I can acquire. If you can see it from there, I know. Now, you know coins are not this big, right? I blew it up for you. You know, so you can see. Can you imagine a coin this size? No, they're not this big. But this is called the Judea Capta coin. Capta because, and if you can see here, there's a palm tree. And remember this morning I talked about the significance of the palm, the palm tree. It became a symbol of Jewish nationalism. You see it featured on their coins and things of that nature, and also in their designs when they chiseled into the stones there for designs in their temple. On one side you have this female seated, and her hands are in her face, and she's weeping, and she's referred to as Judea. And then on the other side of the tree, you have this male figure who is standing, and his hands are on his back. And basically what is signifying is that his hands are tied. He's a captive. Now up here it says Yehuda Capta. This was minted by Rome to tell the world what they accomplished. They destroyed Jerusalem. We got them captive. It's dubbed usually Judea Weeping Coin. And very, very rare, very expensive. I've hunted high and low to get them, and when there was a decent one that looked as clear as this, this was one from the museum in Israel, it was way out of my league to purchase one, so this is about as close as I get. I did ask them, I said, why don't they give me this one, and I could get a lot of mileage out of it, but they wouldn't give it to me. They wouldn't give it to me. All right, well, this is the Judea Capta. Now, the story here with Rome is that God allowed the legions of Rome to destroy the city. And this was done by a father and son team. The father's name was Vespasian. His son was Titus. A father and son team. When the people had basically rejected Christ's messiahship, they rejected God the Father as well. And their cry that we would not have this man rule over us, and then later saying that we have no king but whom? Caesar. Now they are under the rulership of Rome, and it's a father and a son team, because Vespasian would eventually become emperor, and so will his son later. And look what they did. For in the year AD 66, a revolt took place. It started in Caesarea, of all places. It started there, and it began to just grow and went out into the land, up into the Galilee, and then it filtered all the way down into Judea, and specifically in Jerusalem. There was a revolt. Many of the smaller Roman garrisons were overtaken, killed, and of course, Rome then had to send their mighty legions to crush this revolt, and that was the first Jewish-Roman war, the Great War, Vespasian and Titus. What is significant is There was a rabbi. That's not a rabbi. That's me. Okay, that's me. I'm done. That's me. And Janice and I, we hunted high and low in Tiberias today in the cemetery looking for a tomb. Because this rabbi, his name was Yohanan ben Zachariah, or Yohanan ben Zakkai, John the Righteous One. He was contemporary with the Apostle Paul. And he was just as zealous as the Apostle Paul for the tradition, rabbinism that he was taught, that they were taught. But God, in his sovereignty, calls out Paul, and him, he continued on in his merry way. When the city was being besieged by the legions of Rome, Jerusalem, you know what he did? Nobody was being allowed to leave the city, but this rabbi realized that if the faith was going to survive, he had to get out. So he managed to escape from the city, and then he authorized himself to restructure the whole Old Testament system of belief. No longer will Jews need a temple, no longer will there be the need of priests, and no longer will there be the need of sacrifices. Now we'll have synagogues, we'll have rabbis, and in place of sacrifices, we're going to do good works and good deeds. And that's modern day Judaism today. It started here, when the temple was destroyed. The choices that people had now was Jesus who he claimed to be? Or do we continue rejecting him and we embrace this new religious system? God used the legions of Rome to put the Jewish people and the world to this day concerning Christ. What would you do with him? And then finally, let me bring out another guy and we'll close with this. You know, it's amazing that there was a second Jewish revolt, and this guy, his name is Emperor Hadrian. He's easy to identify because he's the only Roman emperor that had a beard. And so every time you see a guy with a beard, that's Hadrian. I mean, you know, in the Roman pantheon of emperors. Hadrian. Quickly, you know what he did? He wanted to build a temple on the Jewish Temple Mount. And the Jewish folks said, oh, this is great. This guy, he's allowing us to build our temple. But then guess what happened? They found out that it wasn't to be a Jewish temple. It was to be a temple to Jupiter, a pagan temple on the Temple Mount. The Jewish people revolted. Again, the legions had to come in and crush. It was a major costly battle for the Roman legions, but they finally won. And then from that moment on, Emperor Hadrian said, okay, this land from henceforth shall be referred to by Israel's mortal enemies, the ones that they hate the most, the ones that they dislike, the Philistines. This land shall be called Palestinia, where we get this term, what? Palestine. It was an insult. And the Jews are from henceforth to be known as Palestinians. It was an insult. Because it's a naming after the Philistines here. And thus that name stayed until 1948, when Israel became a nation, and now we're no longer referred to as Palestine. We are what? It is Israel. We're not Philistines. We're not Palestinians. We are what? Israelis. If you went to an Arab individual before 1948 and you said you were a Palestinian, you know what he would do to you? Yeah. It would be comfortable saying you're a Jew. And he would take a great offense at that. Now, what happened? Oh, now it's a, you know, something that, you know, we're a viable entity of a people group, deserving of a land and a capital and a whole recognition. But it was Emperor Hadrian who started that as an insult to the Jewish people. There are no Palestinians. There are no Palestine. It's always been what? Israel and the Jews. One can learn a lot from the Romans. And so, I came, I saw, I conquered. Okay, big deal. My God is greater. He's in control. And he even used these guys for his grand purposes. And Lord willing, we will discuss the specific armaments and how it applies to our Christian life.